Now, it's 70 years since one of the world's most exciting and remarkable culture collections was born. And it wasn't born in one of the world's major metropolises. It wasn't in London or in New York or in Paris, but it's actually here in Ireland, because we're talking about the Chester Beattie Library, which is on the grounds of Dublin Castle, only a stone's throw from where we are right now, which was set up in 1950. And it's a fascinating story for several reasons. Firstly, because of how a single collector managed to assemble such an amazing trove of materials from all across the world, but also because of how an American mining millionaire ended up settling in Ireland and gifting his treasures to the Irish state. So how exactly did a man who was not only an American mining millionaire, but also a personal friend of Winston Churchill, end up receiving an Irish state funeral after donating such an amazing collection to the Irish people? Well, if that doesn't sound like a story that Donal Fallon would know the answer to, Donal Fallon is here to tell us all about
it. It's good to be here. People's weekly escape into the past.
There we go. Well, there's plenty of things to try and escape from the present, so there's no harm to just indulge yourselves for a little while. For the most part, and what's perhaps so remarkable about the Chester Beattie is that usually our museums only tell our own story, really, don't they?
Yeah, and we've no shortage of brilliant museums. I mean, the National Museum of Ireland on Kildare Street, back open for business. What an amazing place to walk around. And it reveals the depth of history this little island has. You know, Celtic society, the Viking settler, the bog bodies from BC times. Absolutely amazing things to look at. But we were a relatively minor player in the colonial world. You know, we were mostly a colony with some hands in colonial business in places like India, but not much. So we can lack the kind of artefacts in our museums that you encounter, say, in the British Museum, which is the source of endless debate, of course, in recent years over what they should keep and what they should give back. But the great exception, I suppose, to our museums full of great Irish materials only is the Chester Beattie Library. Today, in the grounds of Dublin Castle, there since 2000, an amazing international collection, you know, spanning everything from Egyptian books of the dead to Islamic art, from beautiful Japanese ceremonial artefacts to some of the earliest surviving Christian artefacts in the world. It's just mind-blowing. And I remember as a kid being struck by this amazing feeling of kind of utterness, you know, when you walk through it. It just didn't feel like anywhere else in Dublin.
How have we got all these original Qurans and stuff?
Yeah, what's going on there? How did all of this end up here? All this exotic foreign stuff. And I think a lot of people, and I did for a long time growing up, presume that the collector was an Irishman, you know, but in truth, the story is much more exciting than that. It begins in New York City and it spans basically the entire world. And it's a story of an adventurer in a rapidly expanding world. And let's be honest, you know, about this stuff. It's an industry of kind of dubious morality. You know, a lot of this stuff came from places that were being mined and mined and mined in the early 20th century. But, you know, it's a great story of one adventurer, if you will, and his private collection.
Well, tell us then about how that adventurer came to pass. And he was born, this adventurer, of course, being Alfred Chester Beattie, was born right in the heart of Manhattan in New York City.
Literally the heart of Manhattan. If you stand on the grounds of the Rockefeller Center in New York City today, the middle of everything, you know, you're standing at the birthplace of Alfred Chester Beattie, born in New York City, 1875, son of a banker and a stockbroker. And that's often the case, isn't it, in the stories of great American successes. I'm looking at Donald Trump here, but you know, it's always been the case. The rags to riches story very rarely happens. You know, more commonly it's the richest to richest story. And that's how it is with Beattie. He's the son of a stockbroker and a banker. But what was unusual about him was that he didn't follow daddy into that line of work. Instead, he decided from a young age that, you know, what he was going to do was make his money in mining. So he went to the Columbia School of Mining in the 1890s and then set off for Denver, Colorado. Just imagine how weird that is. You know, the son of a New York banker and stockbroker saying, no, forget Wall Street, I'm off to Denver, Colorado.
But maybe understandable, you know, it probably seems weird at this kind of remove, but maybe felt understandable at the time because this was on the cusp of the 20th century and everyone thought that they were basically a millionaire in
Everyone felt the money was in the mines and they just had to get there. And it was happening everywhere, the gold rushes, you know, the Uitlanders or the foreigners, as they were known, in South Africa. I mean, arguably it was the gold mines in South Africa that caused the Boer War with Britain. I mean, there was a real gold rush happening everywhere. But in North America too, you know, many people felt, this is a real American thing, isn't it, that there's only millionaires and millionaires waiting to happen, that their time was upon them. And Alfred Chester Beattie, off he went, right into the heart of the action in Colorado, working as a mucker, as they were known, for less than $2 a day. So, you know, I have great respect for someone that was able to climb down rather than up the social ladder. But he followed the money, so to speak, made for Cripple Creek. That was the largest gold producing area in the world. That's the centre of the American gold rush. And beautiful words, he says, I still have beer tastes, but I hope to get the champagne someday. and a millionaire but a grand old age of 32.
So he got to the champagne eventually in good time anyway, at the grand old age of 32. And of course, a millionaire in those days, far more salubrious and extreme than a millionaire of these days. After that, then, he relocates himself to the heart of the empire.
Yeah, and I mean, America was this great capitalist society, but what America didn't really have was a colonial world. And, you know, he felt that if you wanted to make it, London was the place to go. It was the centre of world capitalism. And the fundamental difference, I suppose, with America was the deep colonial connections right across the world. So he bought a very impressive house for himself, very modest house, Kensington Palace Gardens. And together with his...
Sounds very understated.
Very understated postcode as well. And together with his wife, Edith, they kind of set about building a life in the heart of the empire. Britain was the door, if you will, into Africa and into Asia.
This brings us to the whole question of his collection, not only of art, but of books and other antiquities as well. And I suppose it sort of begs the question as to why was he such an avid collector, and why was collecting taken off so broadly at the time anyway?
Michael Flatley of Riverdance fame has a copy of the 1916 proclamation. You know, wealthy people generally just collect things, rich people collect things, and to be honest, mostly they seem to collect kind of gaudy things which will not age particularly well. But Beattie had a really remarkable eye, and he kind of invested accordingly. And I mean, he's a self-educated man in this sphere of life. He hasn't studied art or religious history, but he devours books on all of this, and that influences his purchases. So, you know, it's a time before eBay. When you want to get this stuff, you literally have to go out there and find it. And as a young miner, he collected stamps. Often stamp collecting kind of leads people into the world of antiques, and then moves on to kind of Chinese snuff bottles and keeps moving up and up to manuscripts. And his wife develops her own kind of peculiar tastes. She collects Marie Antoinette's furniture.
Which is, that's a sentence that's I never a, thought I'd
a,
ever hear
that's
said.
That's a great one. Marie Antoinette's fur. Eventually, she donates it to the Louvre in Paris. So they're not your everyday collectors of antiques.
No.
But the expert on this figure is Charles Horton, who works in the museum, in the library, I should say. And he's written about this kind of age of collecting more broadly, and how Beattie can only be understood if you look at the bigger picture of who else was collecting. And, you know, there are all kinds of reasons. Some of them, like one of his great opponents, you might say, Alfred Chaplin, was the Speaker of the New York State Assembly, who was building an enormous collection too. And he said, you know, the most fully representative collection possible of those fundamental books and manuscripts which constitute the greatest humanistic tradition so essential to a liberal arts education. That's what he was collecting. Mm. By comparison, we don't really know why Beattie was collecting. He never said on record, this is the reason I'm doing it.
Yeah, so it wasn't designed to be something eventually for public sort of digestion. No. It was just his own little private library.
But Horton's uncovered what he didn't like. You know, he's very dismissive of modern art. He said, get a group of common artists, fill them full of champagne and vodka, furnish them with big brushes and masses of canvas. One group would scrape the paintings down, the other would daub them, and you'll evolve a new school, arrange a series of collections, and everyone would in two. So he didn't like the emerging contemporary art of the day and was much more interested in kind of delving deeper and deeper into the past.
Okay, which I suppose is why there's no Jackson Pollock down on the grounds at Dublin Castle. I suppose that makes sense at least. He did have a sense. We mentioned that he didn't initially try to assemble this whole collection for public consumption or whatever, but he did have a sense of public good, and he did support the aforementioned British Museum.
He donated a lot to the British Museum, beautiful kind of rare Egyptian artefacts still on display today. And I think he had a sense of the public value of the art. And Egypt was the big thing at the time. There was an obsession with Egypt in these islands. You even see it if you walk around Dublin, Bewley's Oriental Cafe, the imagery on Bewley's.
We've mentioned that before, yeah.
The godforsaken statues of the Shelburne Hotel around that will run and run and run.
I was wondering if you were going to come in some week and decide we were going to talk about those statues.
Michael McDowell's calling them the Shelburne Four, isn't he? They should go back up on display. But Egypt was the great public obsession of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And he kind of paid his due, if you will, to the public by donating Egyptian pieces to the British Museum.
Fair enough. So he was a big fan of the British Museum, and he had moved to London because he believed that that was the global capital of capitalism, if you like, and that was going to be from where he would spread out his empire. But he falls out of love with Britain
I think
after the war.
Beattie's great faith was in capitalism, and I think when he thought the British were losing faith in it, it was time to go. You know, he was a solid conservative, a friend of Winston Churchill, and then post-World War, he gets a knighthood from the British for his wartime loyalty. But look at post-war Britain. I mean, the Labour Party come to power. You know, you have the NHS and the like. And he looks at it and he thinks, this is the end of this country as I knew it and as I loved it. And he says, for the mining community, our position will deteriorate. There'll be high taxation, unjust duties and rigid controls stopping new mining projects from being launched. So he looked at people like Nay Bevan, you know, that Labour Party government of 45, and said, this is a creeping socialism and it's time for me to go.
And so then he eventually abandons Britain and he comes to the neighbouring island, of course, much to our benefit, despite the fact that, of course, at the time he moved, we had Labour in government here as well.
In his mid-70s, in his mid-70s, he brings this entire remarkable collection with him. buys a large house for himself on Aylesbury Road, so he still has the same tastes he had when he went to Britain, and a site in Shrewsbury Road for the construction of a library. It only went to Dublin Castle.
If there are two addresses that you needed to know about the extent of this guy's wealth, the fact that he bought one house on Aylesbury Road for himself and another on Shrewsbury Road in the middle of the embassy belt just for all of his stuff. That's
it's
impressive.
Amazing, isn't it? And I mean, he's made a free man of Dublin in 54. 4 years after he arrives here, they make him a free man of the city. Then they make him an honorary citizen in 57.
The first ever.
Which is remarkable. Mm. You know, so I think ultimately when it came to his kind of changing view of the neighbouring island, you know, to use the old saying, England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity. And we definitely took advantage of him falling out of love with England. So, I mean, the state inherited one of the most remarkable and international collections of art and manuscripts in existence because of a general election in Britain, you could argue.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable stuff. And again, actually, when you only look at the timeline there, if he only arrived in 1950, was a citizen after 7 years, and then when he died in 1875, he was the first private citizen to be given a state funeral.
He dies in 68. They bury him in Glasnevin, and a really beautiful headstone, a bit like De Valera up in Glasnevin. The less words, the better. You know, it just says Alfred Chester Beatty, 1875 to 1968. Mm. That's it.
Really, really fascinating stuff. And interesting, too, that they knocked off the Sir, because even if you're going to be buried in our grounds, you can be one of us, but you can't have your knighthood. Donal, as ever, thanks for that.
I should say, by the way, it's open. The Chester Beatty Library is really beautiful, and they've done a great job on laying it out, kind of social distancing, all of that. So if you want a day out, highly recommend
it. Yeah, do check out the hours on their website as well. And the website, actually, I had a look at it this morning when I knew you were talking about this, and it's very good about Alfred Chester Beatty's own background as well, so really worth checking out. So do make a visit if you can. And Donal Fallon, as ever, thanks very much for talking us through that. Donal Fallon is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here to Me books, and he is the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you will find online.